You're listening to 99.1 WQRT LP in Indianapolis, and welcome to Radio Free Book Club for September 2022. I'm Ken Honeywell. I'm a writer and reader from Indianapolis, and today we'll be discussing a first novel that's gotten a lot of buzz this year, Julia Mae Jonas's Vladimir. I'm joined in the WQRT studio by a couple of new club members and one returning member. I'd like to ask them to introduce themselves. Steve, why don't you go first?
Thanks, Ken. Steve Woods. I'm a financial advisor, and I have a side hustle. I officiate football in the NFL, and am an MFA graduate from Butler, and I had both of Susan and Dan in class, so it's fun to be with them.
All right. Well, speaking of Susan and Dan, Susan?
Hi, Ken. Hi, Steve. I'm Susan Neville. I'm retired from teaching English and creative writing at Butler, and I'm a fiction writer and essayist.
And Susan's book, The Town of Whispering Dolls?
Just won the Indiana Eugene Glick Fiction Hoosier Authors Award.
Yeah, that is awesome.
It was exciting.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Yeah, where can we buy it?
Oh, hey, that's a good one. With supply chain issues, I mean, it's on Amazon and it's on different places like that. And there are plenty of books in the warehouse, but it's hard to get them from the warehouse to a place.
Yeah, interesting.
So you can, or you can get on my website, and I've got a direct link that you can email me if you'd like.
Awesome. All right, Dan.
I'm Dan Barden. I'm a professor at Butler, and increasingly I think of myself as a typist. I just type things, and I don't know what they add up to. I've published two novels, and I've got a memoir that's making the rounds of publishers right now.
Yeah, awesome. Love both your novels. Where can we buy those?
On Amazon.
Awesome. All right. Well, thanks, everybody. So just as we get started, I just want to remind listeners, this is a book club. We actually talk about the book. There will be spoilers. We're definitely talking about the ending of Vladimir. So if you haven't read it or you haven't finished it, this would be a good place to stop listening. And know you can find Radio Free Book Club podcast on Mixcloud and on Spotify and other podcast aggregators, wherever you listen to podcasts. So finish the book and come back and listen. So yeah, let's get started. Who'd like to get the discussion going? Maybe we can start by talking about our narrator. Who is she and what's she all about?
You guys have notes. I don't have notes, so go ahead.
Okay. Our narrator is a 50-something-year-old English professor married to a 60-something English professor, and she is dealing with several things. One is that she's dealing with a new group of students, kind of a third and fourth wave feminist students, and she's quite clearly second wave. And her husband has been accused of sleeping with students, and accused and has until it was specifically made a rule, the university, that was not allowed to happen.
Yeah, and he hasn't denied it, right?
And he has not denied it. He has said all along that it was consensual. His wife actually is a little bit complicit and she's having an argument with herself all the way through the book about gender and women and how you tell a story and how you judge a story and what's true and what isn't. And she also, unfortunately, develops a completely sort of delusional crush on a young colleague herself. So it's a very complicated academic novel.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent description.
Excellent.
I knew you'd do that well.
So
thanks.
You know, I just kind of to dive into her job, and I think one of the themes of the book, or one of the ongoing issues of the book, is that she is an English teacher. She would like to have students pay attention to form. They're not interested in form. They're just interested in representation. So I guess my first question is, what do you guys think of Vladimir the novel formally? I mean, if you had to teach it, what would you say about it? Is it a good novel?
I think I read it for fun before knowing that I was going to be coming here and talking about it. And I think it's a good novel. It's not a great novel. It's a good novel. I really appreciated on a second reading the way the writer is, I believe, along with the narrator, trying to figure something out about the times we live in. So she's very good at bringing up different points and anticipating objections about, you know, how whether the writer's life has something to do with how we judge the book. And she's just really pretty spot on, I think, when it comes to talking about students and the academic world a bit. I say spot on a bit. That doesn't make much sense, but
that makes sense to me.
Yeah. You know, because there are things where I think she's exaggerating, obviously.
Sure.
But ultimately, I think it keeps you reading from one chapter to the next. It's well written. But I do think it's in some ways in the form of looking at both sides of an argument. She's good at character development. It's very smart. And I love the references she makes to other books. And they are books that women often think about, like, you know, Colette's Sherry and The Last of Sherry and different
right.
things like that.
And
so
Rebecca.
And Rebecca. And, she right. teaches Rebecca. And so, yeah, I'm not sure what you really mean by form. That's more Dan's bailiwick, I think. When I think of the form of a novel, I think Dan is just ready to say something about that.
Well, yeah. I mean, I wanted to be careful because I shared Susan's, I don't remember how you say it. It was a bit. It was a good.
Yeah.
Yeah. That resonated with me because it was a good book and I finished it happily. When I read her description, you know, her biography, I thought, oh, she's got a background in playwriting. Maybe this will have some sort of wonderful structure. And it seemed to me, it reminded me of like, things that I've done where it's like I got to a point where I was like, yeah, I don't know where to go with this. I have to like bring in space aliens or something. Something's got to happen. And then this whole scheme of like, you know, kidnapping him and drugging him. And it just seemed like formally it was interesting, but it didn't cohere with the rest of the book in a way that I wanted it to. But I certainly wouldn't say it was a bad novel. I liked reading it. I had some problems with her as a character. And I just sitting here realized that I don't know how young the author is, but she doesn't seem like she's in her 50s.
No,
she's not.
And I was troubled by the frequency of body issues that she had, which seemed to me inconsistent with the 50-year-old women that I knew, that they don't hate their bodies as much as this woman hates
her
body.
I absolutely agree.
Yeah.
Some of the very first things I noticed in this description was, why is she so obsessed with, you know, a chin hair? Or, you know, why is she so obsessed with all of this stuff? And it seems to me that it's the way that a younger person would think that an older woman thinks about her body. And so there were times like that I thought, that's just not quite right. But I sort of forgave her.
Well, it's, I mean, we might want to, like, you know, put an asterisk by that forgiving her, because so much of the book is based upon that self-hatred. I mean, the whole idea of Vladimir and her lust, you know, it's like, I, you know, most of the 50-year-old women that I know are much saner than that. You know what I mean?
Right.
That they wouldn't think this guy was a good idea, even if he was attracted to them, which I don't see why he wouldn't have been. I mean,
sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, one thing is, in the afterword, or there's a book club discussion, and she talks about how she was really influenced by Iris Murdoch, who's one of my absolute favorite writers and has been my entire adult life, and particularly by her Booker Prize winning novel, The Sea, The Sea. And I think she was really thinking about that when you talked about the ending and how odd it seems, because that's basically what happens in The Sea, The Sea. Somebody, you know, is absolutely sure that it's a man. This woman from childhood still loves him, and she kidnaps this poor woman, puts her in a room, and basically does something, you know, it's very similar, but it's the whole book. And you can see from the beginning how completely unhinged he is, and it's an unhinged, it's kind of a moral dilemma, because Murdoch was a moral philosopher, and she said, you know, her thing was that we make up stories about one another and we don't really see the other people as real at all. And so I think that in the end, that's kind of what she realized this is about.
Yeah.
You know, we don't see the characters in the books as individual people. We see them as representative of a type. You know, she doesn't see that young man Vladimir as he really is. She sees him as a type. Same thing happened with her husband and the women he slept with. And the women see him as a type, a powerful, you know, older man. And so I think she was at that point kind of wanting to be in a little bit in conversation with that idea of, you know, how we create stories and how we create stories about other people.
Yeah. I had a question, and Dan, you just kind of brought this up about the book taking shape maybe as a play. So if the affair with Vladimir was the gun, right, and we know by Chekhov that it's got to go off sometime in the third act, right? The way that that gun went off was like a cartoon where they pull the trigger and it says bang.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't feel, there was this momentum building, and that's what kept me turning the pages. And I was excited when she drugged him, but then, like, the sex scene was just totally devoid of passion. And it was kind of a letdown from that promise that I expected, and maybe that was on purpose, but it seemed like a letdown ultimately.
Well, you know, and I thought, you know, the opening scene has a guy zip tied to a chair, right? I mean, you kind of want to know what's going to happen there, but really, it was, I mean, you kind of forgot about that as the book went on. And then, yeah, I don't think she stuck the landing.
And there are questions that occur to me now just sitting here. It's very useful to sit here with smart people. Is why couldn't they have had an affair? Do you know what I mean? It was like, again, like the whole idea that he has to be zip tied in order to, like, get her attention seems sort of incredible to me, particularly since, you know, his wife is, like, you know, screwing her husband, and there's all this mishigas going on. I would have been interested in a story in which she seduced him, but the ground of this story, I'd be happy for somebody to disagree with me, is that she can't seduce him because she's old and withered up, and I don't buy that
at all.
But
he's flirting with her. He's flirting
right, exactly.
with her shamelessly
yes,
throughout
indeed.
The story.
Yeah.
And she's clearly, you know, a hot 58-year-old.
Yeah. So what Yeah, I don't understand why it had to go that way.
At that point, I think she was just trying to keep him from dying. But, you know, like, if I can zip tie him to the chair, then, you know, at least he's not going to fall over and die. But what I don't understand is why doesn't she call 911 or, you know.
Well, again, I mean, she didn't act like a 58-year-old woman, right? I mean, her response to her daughter's, you know, basically her daughter's marriage breaking up and her being pregnant by some guy in the bus station was to go get drunk with her.
Exactly. Yeah. You're right.
Right.
But it would seem to be a big swing and a miss from a woman who's grappling with her age and using all of those things from an experiential standpoint that she's learned in order to attract Vladimir. And I think, Dan, to your point, she had all of those things ready to go. Like Vladimir was, you know, that little doe coming out of the woods and, you know, very tentatively. And then she ties him up. Like she could have very easily accomplished everything just by being a good listener and being very interesting and all of the things that his wife was not. Right. Mm-hmm. Complaining about money and all of these things. I think she had a great opportunity that she just squandered.
Well, and he was clearly more aware of what was going on than she thought he was. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. She even says that she put him in that role.
Yeah. Placed
him in that role.
Why are you asking me what we're going to do next?
Yeah,
it's all up to you. Right?
You're the playwright.
Right.
Yeah, it's funny. It's almost like I don't know what my hardcover's got the juicy romance novel.
Yeah, that's the American hardcover.
Yeah, it's almost like I want to posit that the author was like, nah, this can't be any kind of romance. This can't be any kind of romance. They can't have an affair. We got to go in a different direction. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I would have, and I don't see why.
I'm not sure you're allowed to say that here, but maybe Oreo can bleep us.
Yeah.
Well, she had in the past. I mean, she'd had relationships with other men.
Well, she had that serious relationship, right, with David, the other guy in the department.
But was he in the department?
He was.
Okay, he was in the department.
Okay, got it. Okay.
Yeah, in some ways, I think it's because it's a novel of ideas, and it wasn't meant to be a romance novel. She's like, okay, what am I going to do now? Yeah. I have to figure out. Well, I don't really see him either. I don't know.
But Vladimir
was like kind of a, I don't know. I didn't like Vladimir.
Yeah. No. And it's interesting. She came to the conclusion that he was not the dominant partner in that marriage.
Yeah.
Right? She was better than him.
Yeah. Yeah. I promised myself as I was coming in here that I wasn't going to do violence to another writer's, you know, first book. But I want her to have an affair with a student or have an affair. Well, I mean, he's a bad person for her to have an affair with, right?
Yeah.
I don't know.
So do you grade a first novel differently?
No, I don't grade a first novel differently. I just am increasingly aware of how hard it is to get anything done and to get anything published. And so I just sort of want to celebrate, Julia's accomplishment.
Oh, for sure. I mean, it's
a good
on
book.
A sentence by sentence level, it's beautifully written.
Well, it's a good book and it's got a good structure. I mean, I got like, I've read plenty of books, you know, that I'm just, you know, crawling across the desert trying to finish. And this was not that book at all.
Yeah.
I was disappointed in the ending, but I got to the ending happily.
So back to this idea that students are more interested in representation than in form. Is that a thing? Is this really a generational thing? Or are younger people really just like less tolerant with the excuses we've made all along for bad behavior and racial slurs in old manuscripts? And I mean, is that a thing?
Well, I'd be interested in knowing.
I'll just say, for example, I mean, in business, I've heard a lot of businessmen in their, or businesswomen like in their 50s, who would say that's just the way it was. When I was coming up in business, yeah, my boss was a sexist jerk, and we just put up with it. And as she says in here, I mean, she says, all these kids are now insisting that we don't do these things, and what we do is we call them soft.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So I guess what I'm asking is that really a generational thing? Is that true, do you think?
You're retired. You can answer.
I think a lot of what she talks about is generational, I suppose, but it's also maybe it's the way we look at things now. I mean, everyone here watches our, Game of Thrones, and at the very end when Khaleesi, what is her actual name?
Daenerys,
yeah. When she goes and, sets fire to the whole city, and the next day, I was like, oh my God, I wish she hadn't done that. But I understand why she was sold into slavery, or she just lost her best friend, this and that and the other. And it was a surprising ending. But all anybody talked about the next day that I read were things about, oh, it's a woman going mad again. It's Medea, it's Clytemnestra, it's the mad woman in the attic. It's that same story. And I kept thinking, but it wasn't their story, it was her story, her very specific story. And I think that's what we tend to do now, for very good reason. I mean, when I'm talking too much, so you can cut a lot of this out.
No, not at all.
No, when I was in college, I remember we read no writers by men in my contemporary lit class, none. We read Edward Albee's Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, and I asked who Virginia Woolf was, and Virginia Woolf is probably the writer I most needed at that point in my life. Her ideas, her style, everything. And the professor, who was very smart, said, oh, she's just a minor British novelist. So I could never find out who she, who she was until I did it on my own later on. So, so all we could do as an older woman, second wave, I guess, was to look at stories and say, oh, yeah, it's really interesting how Hardy portrays women in this, or how, you had to find the woman's voice hidden in the characters and trust that those writers were smart enough and observant enough that they were telling us something true. So, I mean, I can see how we all started doing it, but it becomes a little bit lazy as well, because a really great work of art is, so much more. I mean, she says, the narrator, I wanted them to see how suspense was created, how symbols are utilized, how repetition made the ghost Rebecca rise from the page. Again and again, you need to see these things, or they drive me crazy, being so completely obsessed with whether or not people were represented well. Wanting every piece of literature to be some utopian screed of fairness. And
right.
Yeah, I can see that. I mean, I can see that. And, why are you talking about this book like this? There's so much more to it.
Right.
The metaphors, the images, the way it sees
the
world.
Question, I mean, her question specifically was, should we consider certain stories damaging and restrict them from a general audience, not trusting them to take in the story without internalizing the messaging? What's the relationship between morality and art, I guess?
Well, it's funny. I mean, I feel like I just want to say that this is another case where it seems like a young woman imagining an older woman, because she seems less sophisticated on these topics. She seems a little the cranky old guy yelling at the kids to get off the lawn. Because in our world, in the world of teaching, we understand why these things have to happen. And I think most of us, not all of us, but most of us are humble about it and approach those situations with humility and just say, well, maybe this is awkward and maybe this is horrible and maybe some writers that I love are getting damaged, but this is a necessary process. I don't remember what the next point I was going to make was, but what was your question?
Just about, you know, are there just books or stories that should be off limits?
Okay. So here's what I think about that. One of the things that really strikes me, and I'm very aware that I'm the person who's already cussed in this book review, is that there are standards for the academy, and there are professional standards like for your world that don't seem to me to pertain to the rest of the world. Like, you know, when I published my last novel, almost every book group that I took it to was like, why do you have to cuss so much? Is that really necessary? And I was like, do you have cable? Have you watched TV?
You've watched Deadwood, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, like everything, you know what I mean? Everything. You know what I mean? I watched this show about stockbrokers in London last weekend, and it was practically pornographic.
Well, Mrs. Maisel, there's so much cursing in that show even.
But I think there's a sense that when we're in a professional environment, and I think this is where the younger generation sort of overcorrects, when there's a sense when we're in a professional environment or we're in certain kinds of, you know, elite, you know, artistic spheres, that it's like, no, we don't do that. We don't do that here. You know what I mean? And I'm like, of course we do. You know what I mean? Like, you can't tell me, you know, college junior, that I'm the first person you've heard today use that word.
Right.
And yet, because we're in a classroom, they're all clutching their pearls. You know what I mean? Like, why would he use the F word? That's just wrong. And I'm certain that out in the hallway right before class, they were all using the F word, right?
Right.
So
I remember I was at Wabash, and Bert Stern was a professor, and he said the F word. And at that moment, I didn't clutch my pearls, but I was like, oh, he's letting me in. Like, I'm part of the group now. Like, I'm an adult. He can talk to me this way. Or when you hear your parents cuss, I think that is a kind of a transition. But I do think that language is useful in telling part of the story, and to take that out would be disingenuous to certain characters. And if there are pearl clutchers out there, I think they probably just need to get over it a little bit.
Well, you know, George Martin's defense of all the, you know, sexual abuse in Game of Thrones is he said, and in that sphere, unless there's things that I'm unaware of, he didn't get attacked the way that I would get attacked, you know? I mean, and to be clear, this is not something that I believe George Martin said that. He said, you know, rape is an important part of human history. There are rapes in this story because that's how human history, one of the ways that human history progresses, you know? And incest is one of the ways that human history progresses. And you're just like, okay. Like, in that sphere, because we're all entertained, you know? But, you know, I would never say something like that in a classroom. You know what I mean?
Really? Right.
No.
No.
I would say that.
I would not use the word rape in a classroom.
Seriously. Like, even though, I mean, students have talk about rape culture, and that, you know, they actually talk about it quite a bit. It's, you know, if the book glorifies it, then, and doesn't recognize what it's doing, it's probably a bad book. But George R. Martin, and I haven't read the books, but, you have to realize what human beings are capable of, and they're capable of some atrocities. Sure. And you know, literature and history kind of let you see that and maybe prevent it. I don't know.
Would the girls in this college go running to the dean, though, in a situation like that? They wanted the author's or the narrator's husband's head on a spit just based on his affairs. If he had taught something even risque like that, would they go running to the administration? They wanted them canceled right away.
Can you teach Lolita, speaking of Vladimir?
I wouldn't touch it with a 10-foot pole.
You know, I think there's a way in which, as an older woman, I've been able to get away with so much because I've taught Lolita many times and get away with. I mean, it's a great book. It's truly a great book. And so I don't know. But I could see if you were a younger male, it would be a very difficult time to be able, if you think Lolita's a great book, it would be so hard to have that conversation in a classroom. Once I taught the White Hotel, which is probably the most difficult thing I've ever taught in my life, and that was the only time I felt like, why am I doing this? I could get fired for this. I remember dressing up in a suit, which I never do, and being very professorial as we talked about it. But
yeah, I don't want to make it sound like I'm cowed by these things, because I'm not. It's just that what I've learned in like the last 5 to 10 years is that there's no upside to certain kinds of conversations. And so, like, if for example, if a classroom of young people is having a conversation about rape culture, I'm a moderator. I'm not a person that's in there saying a lot of things, because there's just a tremendous amount of mistakes I've made. And I'm fortunate that I have a lot of young friends in my life who are always kind of like saying to me, yeah, we're not saying that anymore, Dan. You can't ever say that again. You know what I mean? And I go, okay, good.
And that's exactly what I think this writer is dealing with in this book, is trying to, you know, both sides of that. And she's constantly saying, okay, I get what they're saying. I understand why they're doing it.
Right.
I would have done it too. She's so trying so hard to see both sides.
And I think she's trying to see everything, both sides of everything. I mean, she wants to have the affair, but she doesn't want to have the affair. She hates Cynthia, but she, you know, wants to love Cynthia. You know, and I think obviously one of the other themes is the, you know, with that sexual relationship, you know, the attraction to power. I mean, these were consensual relationships, apparently, right?
Right.
So, you know, what do we say about that? Are we suggesting that these young women don't have agency?
That's a question she asks all the way through.
Right.
Yeah.
In the beginning of it, she owns it. I mean, she. I think it's in the prologue where she talks about she kind of blossomed under the light of these older men giving her attention. And again, that was kind of a promise that I thought would be fleshed out there later on, and it just kind of fell flat.
It makes me want to write. I mean, it's funny because it's like it makes me want to write a book about. Or now it doesn't make me want to write a book about it. It makes me want to read a book about a female professor having an affair with a student, and to see what that would look like. I mean, when I was an undergraduate, I had this, you know, romantic but not physical relationship with a gay male professor, and it was just clearly romantic, and everybody knew that it was romantic, and everybody referred to it as romantic. And I don't regret it. I mean, I regret it like maybe 20%, like because once I became a professor, I could see the power dynamics that were operating in that case. But I learned so much from hanging out with this person, you know? And you know, there's this argument somewhere out there in the world, written by a woman, I believe, that these are, was it Kipnis? No. There's somebody out there proposing that sexuality is a really, really important part of how a university works, you know? And I don't entirely disagree with that. You know what I mean? I know that there's been plenty of students that have listened to me because they thought I was cute, You know what I mean?
Sure.
And that when I was an undergrad,
so wrong.
Yes. Yeah. But you know, but there, but there's that's part of what teaching is.
Well, yeah. I mean, and I think in the very last chapter, she says when she's imagining the thoughts of the woman who comes to see her, mm-hmm. right? She says, at an age when every moment was important, when we were forming our conceptions of who we had been used and passed off without care. Right?
Yes.
So she's right. So she is, you know, she ultimately, I think, comes to the conclusion that it really is, you know, it really is that person in power's responsibility to use that power wisely.
All right.
Yep, that Billie Eilish song. I hope you don't abuse your power.
Right.
Yeah, no, I love that she actually comes to that because, you know, since the Greeks, there have been that argument that teaching is, I guess, kind of an erotic thing. And when, you know, you read it and you think, yeah, there's some truth to that, I get it. And at the same time, you're like, no, I mean, for those girls, those young girls, it's not about girls as a group or men as a group. It's about the fact that they don't see one another individually and that there's something, you know, very wrong about that. You're not, you know, seeing that person as a real human being with issues. And so,
yeah, I'm going to really shift the topic here. And I just want to say, I love the idea that sometimes a compliment can be more wounding than an insult.
Oh yeah. I love that too.
And she had like, when you give somebody a compliment, you are like less than them. You are equal to them and you're superior to them mm-hmm. all at the same time. That's what's good about compliments. And that someone had once said to her, I can tell you worked so hard on it.
Yeah.
I know. That's so great.
Yeah.
That's so great.
I love that. I had a friend once who, after listening to this woman sing, who was just like mind-blowingly awful, she said, oh, you have such a powerful voice. Yeah. So let's talk about the ending. What about that fire? I suppose there are parallels to Rebecca, but I kind of came out of nowhere for me.
Yeah, it seemed to me like it seemed like the kind of gesture that I do myself when I don't really have a reasonable grasp of what my structure is, of what the structure is demanding. I mean, for me, it's just always like, let's just pull in something and make something exciting happen. And I felt that way.
Yeah, I did too.
I mean, we talked about that, Ken. It's kind of a deus machina where it comes down and it solves the problem for them. Now they become sympathetic almost because they've both gone through this awful experience. And I think they still end up getting plenty of money in
right,
a settlement.
Yeah.
And everything kind of works out. Neither character has developed at all. I don't get the sense that they've learned anything from it.
Yeah, they've kind of settled for each other with a lot of money. But is this a moral judgment, you know, that fire?
No, because they, you know, it worked out pretty well, didn't it? It worked out okay. I mean,
yeah, I mean, they got burned up and were in the hospital for a long time.
Yeah.
But, you know,
I don't know. I didn't take that part of the book as seriously as I took the first part of the book.
I mean, me too.
Yeah. I mean, the first part of the book seemed to be an honest examination of a singular character in a world that I know a lot about, and I was with it, and then it just sort of got a little wacky. But I feel for her because, like, I didn't, maybe she just didn't know where to go, you know?
I think you're right, Dan. It's like, okay, I'm going to find an ending. I'll find the ending sort of from a Murdoch novel, but then I need to do something else, so I'll have a fire. And I think at some point it's... The reason I wasn't as crazy about that last part is that I think Vladimir is a completely different character than the character he is in that last part. I mean, he, in that last section, he's got to be just like, oh, who cares? I'm going to go, you know, I'm going to smoke a cigarette and just throw the cigarette down, and I'm going to go in the lake and fall into the lake. I mean, he just does all these things, and he doesn't when his entire life up to that point had been moving to a small town when he had better offers so that he could protect his wife who was suicidal. You know, all the things that he had done for her, and then seeing that he's actually so angry with her that he just, in that moment, just says, okay, yeah, hey, let's have fun. I'm going to stay here and, you know, believe all the crazy stuff you just told me. So, I didn't like it because it didn't seem like it came out of character. Or like you said, Steve, they didn't grow. It was just a thing that happened.
And what about the very end? Shame. What does that mean? The final word in the book.
Remind me.
Is shame. Well, the last chapter, a woman comes and visits her in the house that I guess they still have in the college town. Mm-hmm. And she is the one who started the action against John.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Uh-huh.
And most of the chapter is the narrator imagining what is going through. I mean, she does that a lot in the book. She imagines a lot of stuff happening in other people's heads and in other people's lives. And she plays out this whole scene in why this woman decided she needed to do it. But the very ending is, here, I'll just read the last graph. Well, she says to the woman, everything is still in front of you. Her eyes fill with tears and she thanks me. I don't mind saying it. I believe it, and she needs to hear it. Dazzling, explosive, pitch dark and blinding light like a steamroller, like a hummingbird in the body, in the atmosphere, in the currents of our blood, on the street corners, hidden in melodies and smells and dropping temperatures and rising speed, in rooms we forgot we've inhabited, clothing we forgot we owned, touch we forgot we felt. Oh, shame. Capital S shame. And I even think that language just feels like not of a piece with the whole book. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, it just seemed like a different author almost.
Yeah, I didn't know what to make of it.
I didn't either. I mean, she brings up shame a couple of earlier times, but it feels folded in.
Right. It's kind of like, related to her opinion of her body and that kind of
stuff. Yeah, yeah.
Steve, you feeling any shame there?
No, I mean that part kind of fell flat too. I hate to be the terribly negative because I've never published a book, right? And I do understand that is very, very difficult. But just from a from being a reader, I was left kind of wanting a better way to tie it up. And something to emerge from that, even if kind of like the Sopranos ending, where we realize that these characters during the entire arc of the show come out at the end not having changed at all. That is, telling, but this didn't land the same way.
Yeah.
I didn't feel like they had shame. They got away with it.
Yeah, right.
And they got some money. And now they're going to travel or buy another home or whatever they want to do.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, and maybe it's, I'm not saying I know what that's about, what that section is about, but maybe we can make it about her complicity. You know what I mean? Because it's like, she's a part of what her husband, if what her husband's doing is wrong, which is a big question. She's a part of it. Mm-hmm. She's supported it. Mm-hmm. She supported it institutionally and personally, you know?
Yeah, and I think she has concluded that it is wrong. I mean, if I get what I think she said earlier on that same last page, I think she said it's wrong.
You can cut this out if it's untoward or if Susan decides it's untoward. When I started teaching at Butler, I think there were 3 male professors who had married students.
That's true.
Yes.
Yes.
And so, like, you know, it was just like part. I'm like, if you're sitting there in one of those rooms that I inhabited 20 years ago and saying, you should never do this, there was like a counter argument in the room there, right? And, you know, I would, like, my stance on all that stuff is sort of like along the lines with what Susan said. I would never. The problem with romantic relationships between teachers and students is that neither person is seeing the other person. Mm-hmm. That's what's wrong with them. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know. Like, if you could convince me that was a relationship between equals, I don't know what I would say to that person. You know, like, you know, I'm having the greatest love affair of my life with one of my students or one of my professors. I mean, I would not feel like I was in a position to judge that person. But as a phenomenon, it's just vastly problematic. And the way that I would see her husband, I don't remember his name, but the way that I would see her husband is that he's a clown. You know what I mean? And that men that do those kinds of things, that men that abuse their authority in that way, are clowns. They're to my mind, they're objects of pity. Hmm. I pity them. Mm-hmm.
I think you can say that. And I think one of the things that the narrator's dealing with is, okay, when you talk about when you were first teaching, the argument would be, but that was a different time. I mean, that's right, what she's dealing with all the way through the novel. Her husband was, I mean, I think there's a difference. You have to make a difference between somebody who says, okay, you're no longer a student, I no longer have power over you, you know, you're a young adult, you make a choice, blah, blah, blah. I guess I can see that argument, but I also remember, and I'm going to use a completely different university, you know, in graduate school. And I know, you know, some of the people that you taught with are not taught with, but, you know, were your professors. And some of them were unbelievably predatory. They were so predatory. You would see, like, one of my professors, little VW bug out in front of that graduate student, that undergraduate, which was pretty horrifying because you were really aware that there was such a power inequity there. I mean, it's not just getting grades, writing letters. It is those students, as she mentions, who don't get the letters because they, you know, they aren't involved in that way. And so it's problematic. And the question of, you know, what you do, I don't know. It comes down to, I mean, I think a lot about Woody Allen's Manhattan, which when I first saw it, I loved. I thought it was so brilliant.
Sure, we
so
all did.
So beautiful. And then, you know, there's some things that I can look at and say, oh, yeah, that guy was a jerk. And it's not because Woody Allen was a jerk. It's because the movie portrays a jerk, and you can tell that the director has no insight into that. It has no sense of that girl as a person, has no sense of himself. He just is completely living in a world of unreality. And that makes it, I think, ultimately a bad film. You know, it's just, it's not true. It's a lie. And sometimes it takes a long time to figure out, and maybe, you know, we'll get back and love that film again. But yeah. I don't know. It's hard. We're living in the time we live in, and we're affected by it.
I don't think we're going to get back to loving that particular
thing. I don't know.
In my lifetime, I think I'm too old.
I think I'm way too old to, you know, but at the time, why didn't I see that? Why didn't I,
look
at that poor girl and think,
but you were product of those
13.
Times too.
I was.
You know, as I said, yep. I mean, all these young women in business whose bosses hit on them, who said horrible things in their presence. You know, that was just kind of the way it was.
You watch Mad Men.
Right.
And you think, oh, I'm so glad I didn't live then.
And Mad Men is a tempered version of what happened.
Oh, I know. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
As I've said many times, those guys, the young guys on Mad Men, those guys were my bosses in ad agencies in the 80s.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, that was.
So were you drinking all day?
We had many drinking lunches. Yes. Drinking lunches and sitting at my IBM Selectric with a cigarette in one hand and a cup of coffee in the other hand, pounding out copy. Yeah, those were the days. So we're kind of getting to time here. What would you recommend it?
I would, because I think it's a conversation that we want to have. And I think it would be great for a book club because people would have that conversation and would do some good thinking.
Yeah. Dan?
Yeah, absolutely. For the same reasons that Susan just listed. I mean, I started reading. I was hoping to get it done before this, but there's another book called My Dark Vanessa that is like mines the same vein. Yeah, it's something that we need to read about, even if the execution is imperfect, which to be honest, the execution of most novels is imperfect. That's just the way novels are.
Controlled crash.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Steve?
Oh, same. And, you know, to one of Dan's earlier points, I was reading this book on a flight, and I was very self-conscious of the cover.
Oh, how funny.
It's got the sexy torso, and it's like, I wonder what people, and then I even thought, should I take the cover off? And then I wrestled with that. And, I do think it's certainly thought-provoking, and it's got all the goods that a book club with several bottles of wine, if other people's book clubs or anything like what I hear my wife's is, it should spark a lot of conversation.
Yeah, I agree with you. And by the way, I've seen some of the foreign covers, and they're really quite a bit better than the American cover.
Not surprising.
Yeah. So great. So great discussion, everyone. So we just have a few minutes left. I want to make some recommendations, make a round of recommendations. Steve Woods, what do you got?
In kind of the self-help vein, I read a book called Chop Wood, Carry Water that is a very quick read and just talks about doing all the little things perfect. And I kind of read it from an officiating standpoint, but it's one that I recommend a lot. And I think it's applicable to, you know, every business out there. But that's a good one.
Yeah, cool. Dan Barton?
Well, I brought my book, which I'm going to give you, Benjamin Labatut, who's a Chilean author, wrote a book called When We Cease to Understand the World. And it's my favorite book of a whole year. Describe it, it's a book about the first part of the 20th century when all these mathematicians and physicists were figuring out quantum mechanics, and it's about how it drove them all mad, and they just like there's all these like brilliant men sort of lost their minds, and it was just a thrilling read. I didn't understand half the stuff that was going
books
on,
like
but
that.
but I loved it, and I'll give you it if you will consider it for a book group and include me.
Absolutely, awesome, I'll really look forward to that, Susan.
Well, actually, I think I'm going to steal your Mike Dark Vanessa, which I think does deal with the same issues, but
and who's the author?
Oh, no, I knew you were going to ask me
that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you. Yeah, no, I hadn't even thought of using that as my recommendation until you just mentioned it, because I was completely enthralled by that book. And I think the characters are less cartoony, and it's another play on Nabokov, and it's really good, and I liked it a lot. The book I was going to recommend is an older book by Timothy Snyder called Bloodlands, and he's an historian, and I just was kind of very, very moved by the horror of the history of Ukraine and Poland, and so that was a really interesting book to me.
That sounds amazing. So I'm a sucker for campus novels, and I wanted to maybe recommend a campus novel. And I thought about Lucky Jim. Man, what a great novel Lucky Jim is. And then I thought about The Art of Fielding, which I thought was also a great first novel. And it made me wonder why that guy, Chad Harbach, hasn't written another novel. And you know, Wonder Boys and Straight Man, there are lots of great novels. Right. But I ultimately settled on not a campus novel, but a school novel. My recommendation is The Prime of Miss Jean Brodie.
Oh, yes.
I love Muriel Spark. And I think it is an awesome introduction to Muriel Spark. You know, Miss Jean Brodie is a woman in her prime. She's a teacher in a girls' school in Edinburgh. And it has one of my favorite opening lines of any book. The boys, as they talked to the girls from the Marcia Blaine School, stood on the far side of their bicycles holding their handlebars, which established a protective fence of bicycles between the sexes and the impression that at any moment the boys were likely to be away.
Nice.
Yeah. And which is maybe a good place to stop talking about Vladimir.
And we are the creme de la creme.
Absolutely. Thank you. Well, you guys have been the creme de la creme for this show, talking about Vladimir. So, yeah, for Dan Barden, Susan Neville, Steve Woods, and all the members of Radio Free Book Club, I'm Ken Honeywell. Drop us a note on Facebook or Twitter. Look for Radio Free Book Club blog on Medium, where you can also find links to previous episodes. You can also find us on Spotify, and join us next month when we'll be discussing Tom Perata's follow-up to Election, Tracy Flick Can't Win. Until then, go read a book.